From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Leşkere Türkiye, devlerin herimi Kurdistan'ı hiyen sünürü Türkiye'l gel herimi. Tırsaka mazın bu halki evan gündeyen ser sünürü peydakiriyav. Jeyne çarabin, gündeyen huyu helayna uferak bacırı.
Could northern Iraq explode into a new front in the war? The Turkish army has shelled Kurdistan and has amassed thousands of troops along the Iraqi border. Then Chiquita is sued for funding, arming, and supporting right-wing death squads in Colombia. And 29 U.S. lawmakers have written a letter to the Attorney General of Colombia asking him to drop criminal charges against one of the country's leading human rights defenders. We'll speak with Ivan Cepeda. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Bush administration has lodged what's being described as an unprecedented assertion of White House authority in its effort to fight scrutiny of the firing of U.S. attorneys. The Washington Post reports the White House is insisting the Justice Department will never be allowed to pursue congressional contempt charges once the president invokes executive privilege. Democrats are preparing contempt proceedings against current and former administration officials over the White House's refusal to release documents and allow testimony. Federal law requires contempt citations to go through the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. But the White House says Congress has no authority to force a U.S. attorney to pursue the charges if the president decides executive privilege covers testimony or documents. A senior administration official said the White House stance would make any congressional contempt citations, quote, a futile and purely political act. In response, House Oversight Chair Henry Waxman said, quote, this makes a mockery of the ideal that no one's above the law. I suppose the next step would be just disbanding the Justice Department, he said. Top military administration officials have announced a new date for when they want Congress to assess the war in Iraq. November. On Thursday, the commander of daily operations in Iraq, Lieutenant General Raymond T. Odierno, said a Pentagon report set for September would be too soon to assess the actual conditions on the ground. President Bush and Republican leaders repeatedly cited the September date in their pleas that Congress reject legislation setting a timetable for a partial withdrawal. The measure collapsed this week after Democrats failed to overcome a Republican filibuster. Meanwhile, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker urged lawmakers to downplay judging the war by the benchmarks they've set. Speaking from Baghdad, Crocker said, in many cases, the benchmarks do not serve as reliable measures of everything that is important. Crocker also gave his assessment of the situation on the ground.
And if there is one word that I would use to sum up the atmosphere in Iraq, on the street, in the countryside, in the neighborhoods, and at the national level, that word would be fear.
Meanwhile, in the House, the Anti-War Out of Iraq Caucus has announced it will no longer vote for any war funding unless the money is spent exclusively on withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq. In a letter delivered to President Bush Thursday, 70 Congress members write, quote, we agree with a clear and growing majority of the American people who are opposed to continued open-ended U.S. military operations in Iraq and believe it's unwise and unacceptable for you to continue to unilaterally impose these staggering costs and the soaring debt on Americans currently and for generations to come. Texas Congressmember Ron Paul was the lone Republican to sign on. A federal judge has dismissed the lawsuit brought by Valerie Plame Wilson and Joseph Wilson against Vice President Dick Cheney and other top administration officials. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge John Bates ruled Cheney, senior White House advisor Karl Rove, and then Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage can't be held liable for the administration's disclosure of Plame's identity. The suit accused the White House of deliberately outing Plame in retaliation for her husband's public criticism of the motives for invading Iraq. In a statement, Joseph Wilson said, quote, we brought this suit because we strongly believe politicizing intelligence ultimately serves only to undermine the security of our nation. Today's decision is just the first step in what we've always known would be a long legal battle. Less than a month after stepping down as British Prime Minister, Tony Blair has begun his new job as top envoy for the Middle East Quartet of the U.S., Russia, European Union, and UN. Blair's role will be limited to imposing reforms on the Palestinian government. He spoke Thursday at a meeting in Portugal.
It is imperative that we succeed, and I'm prepared to try to help in whatever way I can. And I think that in the end, that is the most important attitude for me to carry into this job. And I also think that there is a real will and desire, if people can find the right way forward, to get to that two-state solution that people want. And, you know, just imagine for a moment, if this process were moving forward again, just think how much hope there would be.
The Bush administration has already announced Blair will make no effort to end Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip or curb its settlement growth in the West Bank, nor try to push through an agreement on a final status peace deal. Blair's first announcement was to reiterate the quartet would have no involvement with Hamas, the winners of last year's Palestinian elections. Blair's first day came as newly released documents showed media magnate Rupert Murdoch had previously unknown extensive access to Blair during his time in office. According to the British Cabinet Office, Blair and Murdoch had 6 telephone discussions over a 20-month period, all at pivotal moments of Blair's time as prime minister. 3 of those conversations were held in the week leading up to the U.S. and British invasion of Iraq in March 2003, including one call on the day before the attack. Blair phoned Murdoch in each of the conversations. Murdoch's media holdings, including several newspapers and the Fox News Network, have strongly backed the Iraq war. In his diaries, Blair's then communications director, Alistair Campbell, said Blair was afraid the media would find out about Murdoch's influence. Campbell wrote, quote, "It was faintly obscene that we even had to worry what Murdoch thought." A deputy to Campbell called Murdoch, quote, "the 24th member of the Blair cabinet." The British government had long resisted releasing the documents, but finally relented the day after Blair stepped down last month. Rupert Murdoch is currently involved in a controversial bid to buy the Wall Street Journal. The board of parent company Dow Jones has backed the deal, which now awaits final approval from controlling shareholders. On Thursday, Dow Board of Directors member Dieter von Holtzbrinck announced his resignation over the board's endorsement of the sale. In a statement, von Holtzbrinck said, quote, "I'm very worried Dow Jones' unique journalistic values will long-term strongly suffer after the proposed sale." Newly released documents show top Federal Emergency Management Agency officials have suppressed internal warnings about dangerous levels of toxic chemicals in trailers inhabited by Hurricane Katrina evacuees. Several emails show FEMA field workers warned the evacuees were living amidst levels of potentially cancerous formaldehyde gas that was 75 times the recommended maximum for U.S. workers. As many as 120,000 families lived in the suspected trailers. Hundreds have complained of health effects, but the emails show FEMA officials were only concerned with avoiding any legal liability for the evacuees' potential health problems. 3 months after the complaints surfaced publicly, a FEMA official wrote agency lawyers had advised against carrying out tests because doing so, quote, would imply FEMA's ownership of this issue. On June 15, 2006, FEMA lawyer Patrick Preston wrote, quote, "Do not initiate any testing until we give the okay. Once you get results and should they indicate some problem, the clock is running on our duty to respond to them." 11 days later, an evacuee who'd complained about the chemicals was found dead in his trailer. In a subsequent conference call, FEMA attorneys rejected calls for an independent investigation into his death and wider trailer tests. In Darfur, a team of international geologists say they've discovered the imprint of a vast underground lake that could help put an end to the mass killings there. Researchers say the so-called mega lake is 3 times the size of Lebanon. Farouk Elbaz of Boston University's Center for Remote Sensing said the potential water source could be the key to peace.
What most people don't really know is that the fight, the war, the instability in Darfur is all based on the lack of water. Simply put, nothing else. So now, if you find water for the farmers, if you find waters in addition to that to the nomads, and if you find water in addition to all to these two for agricultural production, to feed them, to get them grain, then you resolve the problem completely.
Up to 400,000 people have been killed in the Darfur conflict between Sudanese-backed militias and rebel groups. In a report last month, the UN Development Programme said widespread environmental problems are the root of the violence. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff has announced the government is set to begin building a controversial Texas border wall later this year. In an interview with the Houston Chronicle, Chertoff said he won't rule out using powers of eminent domain to seize land for the wall along Mexico's border. The wall plans have drawn heavy local opposition. Officials say they hope to have at least 150 miles of wall in place by the end of next year. And the House has voted to reject President Bush's plan to cut more than $400 million in funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The final vote was 357 to 72. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, an interesting piece you wrote in the New York Daily News on more deaths as a result of the environment at Ground Zero.
Yes, I reported yesterday that two more people have died at the end of June. Fred Gussin, who was a detective with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office for many years, and an OSHA inspector, George Allen, who had worked at Ground Zero, monitoring the health and safety of people, the recovery workers. Both of them died in late June of cancer. Gussin actually had worked on all of the major terrorism cases in New York over the last two decades, going back to the assassination of Meir Kahane and the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the conspiracy trial of Sheikh Rahman, all of these. And he was heavily involved 24 hours around the clock in investigations and interviews right after 9/11, but was overcome at one point by a dust cloud that got him that initially got very sick. He then was diagnosed with esophageal cancer a couple of years ago. Actually, last year, at the beginning of last year, it spread throughout his body, and he died on June 22nd. And then George Allen, who had volunteered just for 1 week, he was from an OSHA inspector from Colorado, and he came.
OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health.
Yes, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and he volunteered, came from the Colorado region to New York City in November, worked on the pile, immediately started having respiratory problems, and had a series of health problems for the next few years. In Gussin's case, the New York City Pension Board, the New York City Employees Retirement System, recognized that his cancer was work-related. But in Allen's case, the federal government denied his workman's compensation claim. He was fighting it when he died on June 25th. He was still seeking to get the government's ruling overturned.
You said Gussin was a Syrian-born U.S. citizen, fluent in Arabic and Hebrew.
Yes.
Only Arabic-speaking detective.
Well, in the early years, he was the only Arabic-speaking investigator in the entire city. And he was often attached to the FBI. But clearly, the FBI has improved a little bit in that way in recent years.
And how many more people are in such dire, close to death? Now.
Well, I mean, the numbers, the problem is, especially when it comes to cancer, it's very hard to prove what was the initial cause. And obviously, many medical experts say cancer has a latency period, really 15 to 20 years. So seeing cases 5 years later is very unusual. But others say that the witch's brew of toxins that were there at Ground Zero could have affected immune systems to the point that the old ways of looking at of how cancer is caused might not apply here in terms of Ground Zero exposures, but definitely in terms of respiratory problems, lung scarring. There are really thousands of people that are suffering from them, and increasing numbers of deaths that are being directly attributed to the respiratory and other problems that arose immediately after 9/11 for both. Especially for the recovery workers, but also increasingly for people who lived in the area of Ground Zero.
Do you think Michael Moore's film Sicko is making more people around the country aware of the 9/11 workers' illnesses?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that that actually, see, one of the things that people don't understand is so many people came to Ground Zero from around the country, both rescue workers and construction workers and health and safety officials like George Allen, that really, it's not just a New York problem. There are many places around the country where this is already known, that there were problems that continue to affect people who were there at Ground Zero in the months after September 11th.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this as we move across the globe.
Yes. Well, while lawmakers on Capitol Hill debate the war in Iraq and the so-called troop surge in Baghdad, tensions along the Iraqi-Turkish border are running high. News reports indicate that Kurdish-dominated northern Iraq could soon explode into a new front in the war. Over the past few weeks, the Turkish army has been building up thousands of troops along Iraq's northern borders. It accuses the Kurdish regime of harboring Kurdish militant groups it says are responsible for attacks inside Turkey. On Wednesday, the Iraqi government formally accused Turkey of bombing northern parts of the country. The Turkish ambassador to the United States, in turn, asserted that the Kurdish Workers' Party, or the PKK, was being indirectly armed by the U.S. military. He accused the U.S. and Iraqi governments of not doing enough to prevent PKK attacks against Turkey, paving the way for Turkey to take military action.
Iraqi and Kurdish leaders suggest a Turkish invasion into northern Iraq could happen very soon. They say the Turkish army is just waiting for the results of this Sunday's parliamentary election and hoping to fully consolidate its power before it launches an attack. We go now to Turkey to speak with Scott Peterson, chief Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, the paper's Istanbul bureau chief. He joins us now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you talk both about the elections and what is happening along the border with northern Iraq, with Kurdistan?
Well, let's start along the border. I mean, at the moment, there has been a large surge of Turkish troops over the last few weeks. Some analysts say that this is part of the normal measure that is taken by the Turkish military to counter the annual spring offensive from the PKK. On one hand, others say that numbers are larger this year because it is more likely that the Turkish military is going to cross into northern Iraq to deal with this deal with attacks that they see as emanating and coming from northern Iraq. But I think that that in terms of what the Turkish military is going to do or is willing to do, there are an awful lot of politics involved at the moment. I mean, the government, of course, is up for election just this coming Sunday, and they have been at loggerheads with the military over the last few years over a number of issues, in part because the ruling party is an Islamist rooted party, and so they have had their own issues. So analysts here are thinking that it's not so clear that the Turkish military wants to go into northern Iraq as much as they want to pressure or even embarrass sometimes this ruling government. Turning toward the elections, we do have a vote coming up on Sunday. It's for the parliamentary elections. What's likely to happen is that the ruling Islamist party is going to lose its two-thirds majority. At the moment, what they are hoping to gain is an absolute majority of 51% of the seats in parliament. Almost certainly there will be new parties in parliament, which will make things a little bit more democratic. But, of course, the primary issues seem to be what really defines modern Turkey, and that is the difference between those who are interested in a more Islamic path for Turkey and those who adhere to its secular traditions, which, of course, were set up by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk when he created the Turkish state in 1923.
And Scott Peterson, this allegation by Turkey that the United States is indirectly assisting the PKK, is there any evidence of that, given the fact, obviously, that isn't the PKK really historically more of a left-wing insurgency, a secular insurgency that would be unlikely to be supported by the United States?
Well, the PKK really disappeared as an organization for the past 5 or 6 years. I mean, in 1999, its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, was captured by the Turks. In fact, and in his first appearance in court, Öcalan said that the PKK had made a number of mistakes during their 15-year separatist war, that they should now try and work within the state and with state structures to find recognition of Kurdish rights and recognition of Kurdish culture. So, he also said that they're no longer fighting for a separate Kurdish state. So those were all quite important changes that really kind of took the wind out of the PKK sails for many years. What we've seen in the last year or two now is a surge of PKK activity in terms of attacks, certainly in terms of attacks that the government attributes to the PKK, and those are both in Ankara, others also in Istanbul, some targeting civilians and many targeting also soldiers, especially in Kurdish areas of southeast Turkey. Now, of course, the issue of who is supporting the PKK is a very thorny one because, of course, the PKK remains on the list of terrorist groups as officially designated by the U.S. State Department. The United States has identified and chosen a special envoy specifically for countering the PKK. That's the title of Joe Ralston, General Joe Ralston. And of course, the U.S. denies that it is giving any support to the PKK. But from the Turkish point of view, they say, wait a minute, there are American forces who control all of Iraq. And therefore, since the PKK has bases in northern Iraq, that means that by definition, there are, that the U.S. is somehow involved, if nothing else, in turning a blind eye. And you've also got apparently safe haven given to the PKK by Iraqi Kurds in northern Iraq. And the reason for these latest accusations or allegations is just in the past 10 days or so, there was a press conference that was purported to be from four PKK members who had fled northern Iraq. They appeared in Ankara at a press conference wearing masks and saying, we have just fled, the PKK militants are leaving leaving their bases expecting a Turkish invasion, and that also they had witnessed, they say, American troops actually offloading weapons at PKK bases for the PKK. Now, I've spoken to senior Turkish police officers who feel that the entire story is concocted, and I'm sure that would be the American view too. But again, it really does raise a lot of popular questions in the minds of Turks.
We're talking to Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's speaking to us from Istanbul in Turkey. We'll come back to him, and we'll be joined by Laura Rosen, who's been writing some very interesting pieces, and Mother Jones, about the situation in Kurdistan and Turkey. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Scott Peterson is on the line with us from Istanbul in Turkey with Christian Science Monitor. We're also joined by Laura Rosen, the national security correspondent for Mother Jones, contributor to the Washington Monthly and National Journal. She's been closely following this story and recently profiled the Kurdistan regional government's representative in Washington, Gubad Talabani, for the Washington Monthly. In May, she wrote an article for the National Journal. It's called Iraq's Potential New Front. Laura Rosen joins us now from Washington, D.C. What is your assessment of what's happening right now and your recent piece, Kurdistan's Covert Back Channels?
Good morning. I think the state of play is essentially that the U.S. is overwhelmed with other problems in Iraq. And for for Washington, the PKK problem in northern Iraq is not a top priority. For Turkey, it is a top priority, perhaps the top priority. And for Iraqi Kurdish leaders, including, I think, their representative here in Washington, Gubad Talabani, They see the PKK as a kind of leverage that they could trade to get something else, perhaps, from Washington, their Iraqi compatriots, and their neighbors like Turkey. And one thing in particular the Iraqi Kurds are interested in is a referendum on the status of the city of Kirkuk before the end of the year, which is in the constitution that everyone agreed on, but which the U.S. is hoping to kind of kick the can down the road because there's been a lot of violence in Kirkuk, and the possibility of the city coming under Kurdish control is fiercely opposed by Iraqi Arabs and the Turks.
Laura Rosen, you've also written about a lot of the intrigue that occurs in Kurdistan, especially about a guy by the name of Shlomi Michaels and an Israeli, and the involvement of a possible Israeli intelligence folks in that area. Could you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that has caused, I think, the Ankara, the Turkish government, to be a bit paranoid is they see a lot of foreign involvement in Iraqi Kurdistan, and they fear, I think, that Western powers, including perhaps Washington, perhaps Israel, perhaps some of the Europeans, may support an independent Kurdistan. And one of the things that caught their attention was the fact that there have been about 50 Israelis who've gone into northern Iraq under the guise of being agricultural workers. Many of them were former security officials in the Israeli government. They're working, in fact, on development projects and security training with the Kurdish Barzani clan. But one of the interesting things to note is that Turkey is the biggest foreign investor in Iraqi Kurdistan. And one of the things that gives General Ralston, the U.S. special envoy on the PKK issue, I think, some hope that the U.S., Turkey, and the Iraqi Kurds can come to some resolution of the PKK issue, is that under the surface of all these tensions, there is a lot of economic cooperation among all the parties, and some sense that their futures mutually depend on each other.
And you've also written about the involvement of high-powered lobbyists, Republican lobbyists, in Kurdistan and representing officials there. Could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the Iraqi Kurds have gotten really smart. They've learned from other ethnic minorities in the United States that nothing sharpens your argument in Washington more than a few million dollars worth of high-powered lobbying assistance. So they've hired, you know, they've spent several million dollars the past few years, the Iraqi Kurds have. And they have a very sophisticated operation here. They're running an advertising campaign now, I think, called The Other Iraq, that, you know, shows that Iraqi Kurdistan presents many of the things that America was hoping to find in a post-Saddam Iraq but hasn't. And security, more equality, things like that, economic development.
Laura Rosen, what support does PKK have among the Kurds?
I think there's some. I mean, Iraqi Kurds say they have some emotional attachment to the PKK, but I don't think that is the real obstacle to getting the Iraqi Kurds to assist the Turks and the Americans in finding a resolution to the PKK problem. I think the Iraqi Kurds are trying to find all the leverage they can in this complicated situation to seek the things that they would like to get from the Americans over the next few years.
And, of course, Iran also has a Kurdish minority. Is there any indication of continuing unrest in the Kurdish sections of Iran?
I think there is some violence by Iranian Kurds against the Tehran regime and also by other ethnic minorities in Iran, including the Baluch, the Azeris. There's a lot of rumor and suspicion, including from the Iranian regime, that this is U.S.-backed. It's hard to find evidence of the U.S. supporting these groups. I asked General Ralston a couple months ago, and he said, to his knowledge, the U.S. is not giving any support to the PKK. He said he's got that from the highest levels. But he was careful in answering my question to not mention an Iranian offshoot of the PKK called the PJAK. He kept saying, well, the U.S. is not supporting the PKK. It's not clear to me that the U.S. is not in some way perhaps supporting this other Iranian cousin of the PKK.
I want to go back to Scott Peterson in Istanbul, Christian Science Monitor reporter. These elections that are coming up, the significance of them, and could you see an all-out attack by Turkey on northern Iraq, on Kurdistan?
Well, I don't envision it myself, and the analysts who I've spoken to basically say that this is, at the moment, a lot of hot air coming from the Turkish military, really, really for political reasons, to put the government, current government, in a spot. You know, perhaps to indicate that the military is ready to go, but that the government is weak in fighting terrorism. That's how they put it. And the lessons learned here from the military are that they've made more than two dozen forays into northern Iraq over the past 20 years. None of those wiped out the PKK. Many of them occurred during Saddam's time. Most of them occurred, in fact, during Saddam's time, and really were the result of a treaty that had been signed quite some time before that. And so Turkey was taking advantage of that. But really, in the end, they didn't wipe out the PKK bases. I mean, even now there's some Turkish troops in northern Iraq, and even now there are still some kind of minor hot pursuit operations that take place and regular shelling. Although often, cross-border shelling, which really does seem to just kind of knock out orchards and things like that, more than actual bases. So it's hard to know how effective those things are. But analysts who I've spoken to are perfectly aware that the Turkish military did not achieve an awful lot by crossing into northern Iraq. And these days, of course, the situation is completely different, because instead of dealing with an area that nominally had been part of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, you potentially could be facing off with American troops on the other side, and of course a much, much stronger Iraqi Kurdish operation on just south of the border as well. And I think that Laura is correct in her assessment that the Iraqi Kurds are using the PKK to a degree as leverage against Turkey. I mean, these types of alliances and arrangements change, shift, fluctuate over the years, all the time. I mean, it wasn't so many years ago, in fact, when Barzani's Iraqi Kurds, the KDP, their militants were going through on behalf of the Turkish military, hunting down PKK militants. They helped actually end that problem. Of course, now things have shifted, but these kind of things are really, people are looking, people who are making decisions here, looking for opportunities and just playing the card of the day. So we will see what happens, but I really don't think we're going to see an imminent cross-border operation, because they know it's not going to solve the problem. And once you do send over 40,000 troops in northern Iraq and there's still bombs in Ankara or Istanbul, what will you do then?
And Scott, I'd like to ask you something you mentioned earlier, the upcoming elections. There was a lot of attention months ago to the growing conflict between the secularists and the Islamists within Turkey. How is that playing out now as you're heading toward these elections?
Well, I think that is still the primary defining element, if you will, of these elections. I mean, and kind of the big bear that's just over the horizon here is the military. In fact, even more than what they do regarding the PKK is what they will do regarding a strengthening of the electoral hand of the ruling AK party, which has Islamist roots. I mean, of course, the reason why we saw those huge secular demonstrations a couple of months ago is because the military had a very severe and abrupt reaction when the AK party put up one of its own, Abdullah Gül, the foreign minister, as a presidential candidate. And basically the military reacted and said, do not forget that we're the safeguards of secularism in Turkey and that we will act when we deem it's necessary. Of course, the Turkish military in the last 40 years, 50 years, has conducted four separate coups. Sometimes they really were military coups, and then the most recent one in 1997 basically forced from power the progenitor of the ruling AK party today. It was a much more radical party called the Welfare Party, and in those days, all it took was tanks being rolled into a village not too far from Ankara to cause that party to basically collapse and be outlawed. Today, the military is watching very carefully, and what's remarkable here is that you do get a polarization among people. I mean, you get secular people who say, that if we don't stop this now, what we're going to see is Turkey turning into another Iran. I mean, they really use those two words in the same breath, which, for anyone who lives here and also for anyone who knows Iran, seems to be extremely unlikely and remarkable. And I think that we have seen a a much more mature Islamist party that recognizes where the limits are. They're pushing those limits all the time, but that they are doing it in a way that the way they push, you know, the pro-business and pro-economic policies over an Islamist agenda, that's put some minds at rest, at least.
Laura Rosen, can you tell us who Qubad Talabani is?
Qubad Talabani is the almost 30-year-old son of the current Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, who's the longtime kind of Iraqi Peshmerga leader turned statesman. Qubad was raised in exile in the United Kingdom by his grandparents, his maternal grandparents. He has a British accent. He's very soft-spoken and refined. He's married to the former State Department Iraq hand, and it's a sign of how much he's learned the ways, I think, of Washington. He runs a small office down the street from here near the White House that seeks to get the White House and the Pentagon and the State Department to support the Iraqi Kurdish side of things.
And Iran, the division right now within the Bush administration around attacking Iran. Who's on what side, Laura?
The State Department really is trying to lead, I think, a tough diplomacy route, similar to the one that Chris Hill used to achieve a diplomatic, non-military solution with North Korea recently. And so Secretary of State Rice has appointed Undersecretary of State Nick Burns, a former Clinton-era diplomat and ambassador to Greece, to take the lead internationally on trying to create an international coalition to use diplomacy and economic sanctions and the offer of economic carrots to Iran to agree to suspend its uranium enrichment. And I think the State Department is currently driving the thrust of the U.S.-Iran policy at the moment. It hasn't always been that way. It may not stay that way. I know there are a lot of reports that, in particular, the Office of Vice President Cheney has people who are very skeptical that there could ever be a diplomatic solution with this Iranian regime, and that they may find an opportunity in the coming year, if the negotiations that Burns is trying to lead don't succeed, to seize control of the policy again and convince President Bush that he really is the only one who has the opportunity to take care of the Iranian nuclear problem before he leaves office. Again, he doesn't run for office again, neither does Cheney. So it's not clear if Rice will be able to maintain control of the policy forever. But I do think that there is a sense, and the Israeli representative was recently here saying the same thing, that the U.S. and its allies are going to give till the end of the year to see if economic sanctions can succeed in persuading Iran to change its behavior on the nuclear front.
We're going to leave it there. Laura Rosen, national security correspondent for Mother Jones. Scott Peterson joining us from Turkey, Istanbul, the Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Alfredo Gutierrez here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish, in audio and transcript form, and any radio station in the world can take it, as over 150 are. This is Democracy Now! Juan?
Well, the Cincinnati-based fruit company Chiquita was sued Thursday for arming and supporting terrorist organizations in Colombia. The human rights group Earth Rights International filed a class-action lawsuit on behalf of six Colombians whose relatives had allegedly been murdered by a Colombian paramilitary group that was partially funded by Chiquita. The lawsuit alleges that the banana giant funneled money and guns to a right-wing death squad that murdered thousands of people and shipped untold amounts of cocaine to the United States.
Part of the lawsuit is not in dispute. Earlier this year, Chiquita admitted one of its subsidiaries paid about $1.7 million to the right-wing paramilitary group United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, which is also known as the AUC. The group is considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. Chiquita also agreed to pay the U.S. government a $25 million fine. At the time, Chiquita defended its actions, saying it fell victim to an extortion racket that threatened its employees.
The payments made by the company at all times were motivated by the company's good faith desire and concern for the safety of all of its employees. Nevertheless, we also recognized our obligation to disclose the facts and circumstances of this admittedly difficult situation to the United States government and the Department of Justice.
But authorities in Colombia have taken a different view. Colombia's attorney general said in March that he will seek the extradition of eight Chiquita employees allegedly involved in making the payments. The attorney general, Mario Iguarán, said, quote, "The relationship was not one of the extortionist and the extorted, but a criminal relationship. When you pay a group like this, you are conscious of what they are doing." Marco Simmons joins us in Washington. He's a legal director of Earth Rights International. We invited Chiquita to appear on the program, but they declined to come on. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Tell us about the lawsuit.
Well, essentially, the lawsuit is a class action on behalf of the victims of the Colombian paramilitary organization that was funded and otherwise supported by Chiquita. It's been filed under United States law known as the Alien Tort Statute or Alien Tort Claims Act, which allows lawsuits in United States federal court for violations of international human rights law. And so it allows the victims of what happened in Colombia to come to the United States, to Chiquita's home territory, to seek accountability and justice for the injuries that they have suffered.
Tell us exactly who these people are who have sued and then what the legal theory is that you're using.
Well, I can't tell you exactly who they are because we're keeping their identities secret for their own safety. Although the situation in Colombia has improved somewhat over the past few years, people who speak out against human rights abuses are still being assassinated. Several have been assassinated in just the past 6 months, and so it's paramount to us that the safety of the victims be maintained by keeping their identities secret. In general, however, they are family members of victims of the paramilitaries. And these are victims who were killed for a variety of reasons. There was a labor organizer who was organizing banana workers who was taken off a bus by paramilitaries and shot. People shot in the banana fields. Social organizers who were advocating for causes that the paramilitaries were opposed to, a woman taken out and shot in front of her family. And so these are family members who are now speaking out, but their exact identities are being kept confidential for the moment. In terms of the legal theory, essentially the legal theory is it's similar to what the Attorney General of Colombia was discussing, that Chiquita, by supporting these paramilitaries, becomes an accomplice to their actions, and we believe it goes beyond that. We believe that Chiquita is actually essentially engaged in a criminal conspiracy with the paramilitary organizations to control the banana-growing region of Colombia, and that it was to Chiquita's great benefit to use the paramilitaries to maintain social and political stability within this region to allow them to conduct their extremely profitable banana-growing operations. What the Chiquita executives probably didn't tell you is that during this period when they claimed they were being extorted by the paramilitaries, their Colombian subsidiary was the most profitable arm of Chiquita's global operations. And in fact, they continued to buy land in Colombia, in the area where they said it was so dangerous that they had to pay protection payments to the paramilitaries. They continued to buy land and expand their operations until 2004, when they abruptly sold their Colombian subsidiary at around the same time that the Justice Department began investigating their payments to the paramilitaries.
And Marco Simons, the Chiquita, of course, is the original American multinational corporation, the old United Fruit Company, and had holdings throughout Latin America, Cuba, Guatemala, Costa Rica. How big are the holdings there, and how extensive is the investment of Chiquita in Colombia?
Well, right now, they have sold off their Colombian operations, which they did when the Justice Department started investigating them. But during the period when they were funding the paramilitaries and trafficking arms for them, they were the major banana producer in Colombia, the major exporter from Colombia. And so they were really a huge force, especially in the banana-growing region of Colombia.
I wanted to share with you Chiquita's response. We did ask them to join us. As Juan said, they declined to come on. But Chiquita spokesperson Michael Mitchell did send us a written comment. He said in part, Chiquita Brands International categorically denies the allegations made by the attorneys for Earth Rights International. We reiterate that Chiquita and its employees were victims and that the actions taken by the company were always motivated to protect the lives of our employees and their families. Chiquita's already been the victim of extortion in Colombia. We will not allow ourselves to become extortion victims in the United States. We will defend any preposterous suit of this nature vigorously. Marco Simons, your response.
Well, I first have to say how, you know, horrific it is to me to be comparing paramilitaries in Colombia with the victims of those paramilitaries in terms of equating what they are seeking from Chiquita. And that right off the bat, that's a really horrific way to frame the situation. But beyond that, as I said, the facts that we know at this point really don't support Chiquita's whole position that they were just being extorted. They paid the paramilitaries for a course of about 7 years, during which time their own lawyers were telling them that it's illegal to make these payments and they cannot do it, and that, you know, while extortion may have been a good excuse for a year or two, that over the course of 7 years, that excuse wears thin. They were buying up land. They were expanding their operations. So it doesn't really make sense that this was simply extortion. But even if it was only extortion, it still doesn't absolve Chiquita from liability. You know, there were many war criminals tried during World War II who tried to defend their actions on the basis that they were just following orders, and in fact they would have been executed if they hadn't. Well, that's not necessarily a defense to being an accomplice to war crimes or crimes against humanity, as Chiquita was here. They didn't do everything they could have to prevent violence on the part of the paramilitaries. This was not a one-time extortion payment with a gun to somebody's head. This was a long-term relationship that not only involved the payment of millions of dollars to the paramilitaries, but also in at least one documented instance involved the use of Chiquita's facilities to smuggle guns into Colombia. The Colombian government found that Chiquita's private port, which Chiquita has been found by an investigation of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to have paid bribes to Colombian officials to secure privileges for, that they used this private port to import 3,000 AK-47s and a couple of million rounds of ammunition that were transferred to the AUC. Now, Chiquita, of course, also denies that they had any knowledge that their private, proprietary controlled port was being used in this fashion. But the evidence against them is mounting, and their excuses are really wearing thin.
Was there any indication during the years that they were paying this money that they complained to the Colombian government about the extortion that they say they were under subject to?
Well, the payments appear to have come as a surprise to the Colombian Attorney General. So I'd be very surprised if the Colombian government had any notion that these payments were being made before. So, no, as far as I know, Chiquita didn't complain to the police or the Colombian government that they were being forced to make these payments. And in fact, they were illegal under Colombian law as well as U.S. federal law.
I wanted to go back the history of this story and how it has come out in this country. That also involves the major press in the United States. In 1998, the Cincinnati Inquirer published an 18-page exposé of Chiquita's dealings throughout Latin America. The paper found that Chiquita exposed entire communities to dangerous U.S.-banned pesticides, forced the eviction of an entire Honduran village at gunpoint, suppressed unions, paid a fortune to U.S. politicians to influence trade policy. The Inquirer was later forced to retract the entire story. They issued a front-page apology. They reportedly gave a $14 million to Chiquita in a settlement after it was revealed that the lead reporter, Mike Gallagher, had illegally accessed more than 2,000 Chiquita voicemails. Now, the reason they had to retract the story was over that issue of how Mike Gallagher, the reporter, had gotten the information, tracking the voicemail within the company, somehow got access to that. But the facts were never refuted. This is 10 years ago that this story came out. It was a remarkable edition of the Cincinnati Inquirer. What effect did that have on getting information out about Chiquita?
Well, as far as I know, it didn't have a whole lot of impact on getting information out about what they were doing in Colombia with the paramilitaries. Again, at that time, in 1998, they were making regular payments to the paramilitaries. That fact did not come out at the time. In fact, it didn't come out until 2003, 2004, when Chiquita finally realized that, maybe violating U.S. and Colombian law wasn't such a good thing, and they started working with the Justice Department to see whether these payments should stop or not, although even after they were informed that it was illegal, these payments didn't stop. But you're right that this is certainly not the end or the whole story of Chiquita's malfeasance in Latin America especially. And on the pesticide issue in Colombia as well, the workers in the banana fields have been, in many cases, made sterile by the pesticides that Chiquita has used in Colombia, in Honduras, and elsewhere. And so certainly paying violent death squads to help control the banana-growing region of Colombia is one of the worst activities that Chiquita has engaged in recent years. But it's not the only problem that the company has been involved in.
And what is the Colombian government doing at this stage, if anything, around Chiquita's illegal activities?
Well, as far as I know, they are still investigating who was responsible for these illegal payments. They announced that they would consider, or that they were looking into the possibility of extraditing Chiquita executives. They have not, as far as I know, named the executives involved. That may be because they don't know who they are. The suspicion is that as part of their plea deal with the Department of Justice, in which Chiquita did plead guilty to financing terrorists and paid a $25 million fine, that as part of that deal, Chiquita was assured that the individual executives responsible for this would not be prosecuted. and, you know, their names would not become public. However, the United States has a long track record of extraditing people from Colombia, especially drug traffickers, and so it would be difficult for the United States to refuse an extradition request going the other way when Colombia discovers that United States individuals were involved in perpetrating the horrible violence there.
But so, in other words, Chiquita has paid a $25 million fine to the United States for breaking U.S. law, but has paid nothing to Colombia where the crimes actually were committed.
As far as I know, that's correct.
And the power of the Chiquita company here in this country?
Well, I guess we'll see in part. We've litigated a lot of these cases against corporations for human rights abuses around the world. And one thing that often happens in a lot of these cases is that the Bush administration intervenes to tell the courts that these cases cannot proceed, that they will interfere with foreign policy in some respect. And that, to some degree, is a measure of the political power of the corporations involved. Chiquita, while it is a big player in Latin America and a major fruit producer, is not nearly as large a corporation as, for example, the oil companies that we have sued for murdering protesters in Nigeria. And so it remains to be seen how much clout they really have in this country. And even if they do get the Bush administration on their side, the courts have generally been pretty dismissive of administration arguments that suing U.S. corporations for recognized human rights abuses around the world really interferes with any foreign policy goals of the United States.
Finally, Marco Simons, the whole issue of the Alien Tort Claims Act and what you really could accomplish with this lawsuit. If you could give us the history of how it's been used most often against military officials, soldiers, dictators in other countries who have committed human rights abuses, what do you hope to accomplish here with a U.S.-based corporation?
Sure. Well, yes, the modern use of the Alien Tort Claims Act started around 1980 when the courts decided that it could be used to sue for torture and extrajudicial killings committed by foreign officials. And for about 10 or 15 years, that's how it was used, to sue individuals who were found in the United States who had committed torture and other abuses around the world. And while these cases were extremely important in moving the law forward and in providing a degree of symbolic justice to the victims, almost all of the perpetrators of these abuses, with a couple of exceptions, had no ability to really compensate the victims of their crimes. That started to change in the mid to late 1990s when Earth Rights International and other organizations started suing multinational corporations that were based in the United States or subject to jurisdiction here for their crimes around the world. We sued the Unocal Corporation, a Southern California oil and gas company, for abuses associated with its natural gas pipeline in Burma. And after 9 years of litigation, Unocal finally settled that case on the eve of trial in 2005.
Marco Simons, we're going to have to leave it there. But I want to thank you very much for being with us, Legal Director of Earth Rights International, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. And that does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Anjali Kamet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Kari Mache, Kizzy Cox, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.